You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex Toku Ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki Te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Liam. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For Dear Science this week, our expert, Professor Alan Blackman, talks about hotter superconductors, hexagonal diamonds and pi. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with Ryan Hamilton about the government's pay offer for primary school teachers on individual agreements and the criticism of the move by the NZEI union. We also spoke about the release of the second phase of the Royal Commission inquiry into the COVID-19 response and what it tells us. Liam, what have you got for us today?
Well, I spoke to Deborah Ashton, the chief executive of Safe for Animals, about the government's decision not to go ahead with repealing the ban on live animal exports by sea.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or waia mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ko wa e wareware, e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ke ēnei kōrero ānau, hei pakehere roki roki mā runga i te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia timata te whakaturanga. Let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we have our professor... our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Alan, what have you got for us today?
Hey, Alex, how's things?
Good, good, good.
Good, good. Okay, we're going to kick off talking about superconductivity, which is very interesting stuff, I reckon. And so let's talk about how we transmit electricity. We transmit electricity down wires, and most of it up here comes from down south and comes across the Cook Strait cable, et cetera, et cetera. And on its travels from down south to up here, we lose around about 8% of it just simply through losses due to heat from transmission. Okay, so you can imagine that if we could save 8% of electricity, that would amount to quite a lot and would certainly be economically viable to do so.
Yeah, and that's a high percentage.
It is, it is. And so we use copper wires generally to transmit electricity, and copper wires unavoidably have a resistance to flow of electricity, and this is why we lose 8%, because, as I say, the copper wire heats up due to the fact that it has resistance. In a perfect world, we would use silver wires, but we can probably understand why we wouldn't be doing that. Yeah. Now... So ideally what we want is some sort of wire that can conduct electricity with absolutely no resistance, and then we wouldn't lose any of that energy as it is moved. So it's long been known, in fact since 1911, that these things called superconductors exist. And superconductors are materials, not necessarily very weird ones, that can conduct electricity without any resistance at all, and so that means that we don't lose any energy. And in 1911 it was discovered that mercury, of all things, if you cool that down to a temperature of 4.2 Kelvin, which is okay, which is negative 269 degrees Celsius, yeah, pretty cold, then it becomes what we call a superconductor. And you might ask, well, why 4.2 Kelvin? That just happens to be the boiling point of liquid helium. So you can cool helium down. It's a gas normally. If you cool it down to negative 269 degrees Celsius, it becomes a liquid. And in 1908, they first managed to be able to do that, to get those very, very cold temperatures of 4.2 Kelvin. So they were studying the behavior of materials at very, very low temperatures. They found that mercury was a superconductor at liquid helium temperature. And, you know, that was pretty cool. So that set off a lot of research as to how these things did this and you know, could we find materials that would superconduct at a higher temperature? And so way back in 1986, they got it all the way up to 35 Kelvin, okay? From 4.2 Kelvin to 35 Kelvin, and that actually won the people a Nobel Prize because that was a massive, massive improvement in the temperature at which superconductivity came on. And unfortunately, they awarded that probably just a year too soon because the next year they got it up to 93 Kelvin, okay, which is massive. And so massive, in fact, that was a really, really important advance that was made because that is hotter than the boiling point of liquid nitrogen, okay? Ooh. Now, liquid helium is exotic. It takes a lot of energy to cool it down to that far. Liquid nitrogen... 80% of the air, 80% of the air around us is nitrogen. So if you can cool it down to 77, so that boils at 77 Kelvin, so or negative 196 degrees Celsius. And so therefore, if you've got something that superconducts at 93 Kelvin, you can cool it down with just liquid nitrogen rather than having to go the whole liquid helium thing. So that's a massive, massive advance. And now, one of the researchers who was actually on that paper way back in 1987 or so, his research group at in Texas has now prepared a material that superconducts up to 151 Kelvin. So this is the new world record now, negative 122 degrees Celsius. So that is, dare I say it, pretty cool. No pun intended.
Still definitely not warm.
Still definitely not warm. But, again, it's a massive advance as to what it used to be. Okay, so the material that they used to do this contains mercury, barium, calcium, copper, and oxygen. And so they use quite a neat trick to do this because what has been known for a long time is that if you exert big pressures on materials, that induces superconductivity. So superconductivity is helped at very, very, very high pressures, okay? And ordinarily what you have to do is you have to keep your material under very, very high pressure for it to exhibit superconductivity. But what they found with this material was if they pressurize it to between 10 and 30 gigapascals, which is probably not a number that really means a heck of a lot to anybody, really, unless you're really into pressure. But that's around about 200,000 atmospheres, let's say. So the Earth exhibits one atmosphere pressure. Right. And so that's, you know, that's quite high pressure. And what they did was that they exerted very, very high pressure at very low temperature. So they went down to liquid helium temperature, exert this really, really, really high pressure on it. And then what they found was that when you released the pressure, that the superconductivity was somehow sort of locked in this material. So therefore they could warm it up, and they could warm it up all the way up to 151 Kelvin without it losing its sort of locked in superconductivity. So this is kind of a new way of doing this. And, you know, people are probably thinking, okay, so what? This just sounds like an academic bloody, you know, whatever, whoop-de-doo. But the holy grail with all of this is, as hopefully you can imagine, room temperature superconductivity. Now, that has already been done, but only under ridiculously high pressure situations and with tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of material. So it's totally impractical at the moment. But if we keep making these big advances in these materials and getting closer and closer and closer to room temperature at atmospheric pressure, that's the important thing. So if we can get materials that can superconduct at room temperature at atmospheric pressure, whoever does that first, by golly, they're going to be rich. They are going to be rich. They're going to be instant Nobel Prize, absolutely. No doubt about that. And they're just going to be extraordinarily rich because so many applications of superconductivity that we've got now, and they do require these low temperatures. So for instance, if ever you've had an MRI scan, the magnet in that has to be cooled down to 4.2 Kelvin in order for that to work. And you then get a superconducting magnet that goes on forever and ever and ever and ever. Amen. Doesn't need any energy input so long as you keep it at 4.2 Kelvin. But if we could be doing that at room temperature. Oh, you know, it'd be just such a game changer for humanity. It would just change everything. So this is an advance. I think they've increased the record by about 10 Kelvin there or thereabouts. So on and on they go, and you know, we will continue to make advances, and eventually, I'm pretty sure that, you know, they will come up with a room temperature superconductor. Yeah.
Awesome.
So that's exciting stuff. Yeah.
So much electricity move. Like, I don't know. Like, it's one of those things where it's just like, yeah, turns out we've got a lot of cables. We've got a lot of power going places.
And indeed, New Zealand's sort of at the forefront of this. So a group down at Victoria University have been sort of instrumental in making sort of what we call high-temperature superconductors. And by high-temperature, you mean anything greater than 77 Kelvin. But And it's not enough to just have the material that's going to superconduct. You've also got to be able to fashion it into a wire. And so that's another problem that has to be overcome. You know, if it's a ceramic thing, then it won't have any give in it, so it'll just snap. So it's got to be, you know, it's got to have the properties of these wires that we use now. So, you know, there's another problem as well. But, you know, let's crack the first problem first.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. Hexagons. What have you got for us?
Diamonds. So, hexagonal diamond apparently is a thing. Who would have thunk that? So, why are we interested in diamonds? We're interested in diamonds because diamonds are the hardest known substance.
Yes.
Which is kind of cool. And the reason that they are the hardest known substance is all down to the way that the carbon atoms in diamond are arranged. Okay, so every carbon atom in diamond is surrounded by four other carbon atoms, and so on and so on and so on, all the way to infinity in three dimensions. And that particular arrangement we call a cubic arrangement of carbon, okay? So we get what we call a lattice, which you can make cubes out of, and then extend those cubes infinitely in three dimensions to make the bulk structure of what we call diamond, okay, cubic diamond. Now, way back in 1962, somebody put on their thinking caps and thought, if we take that cubic lattice and just move one layer of carbon atoms relative to the other to make what we call as a hexagonal lattice, so a sort of a six-fold lattice rather than a cubic lattice, then we reckon that that should, in fact, be even harder than diamond. And so this was a theoretical study to begin with. And this was supposed to have been realized about 5 years later in 1967, where they had a material called Lonsdaleite. So the people who came up with this idea said that, okay, in order to get this hexagonal carbon, you're probably going to have very high temperatures, very high pressures. People thought, where do we get very high pressures, very high temperatures? Aha, meteorites. Okay, so, you know, they're coming
classic.
In, bam, 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 bam. So they get very hot in the atmosphere. They hit the Earth, lots of high pressure. And, surprise, surprise, so they supposedly found this Lonsdaleite, this hexagonal carbon in a meteorite in 1967. And ever since then, it's sort of been a source of controversy because the data have been equivocal, let's say. And, you know, people are thinking, oh, it's not this pure hexagonal diamond. It's probably a mixture of cubic diamond and hexagonal diamond. And they've never been able to isolate a decent amount of a pure sample of this. So we jump to the present day and we go to a bunch of Chinese workers who have just published a paper in Nature. And this now appears to be a pure sample of this hexagonal diamond, and they've made it now in quantities, and they're talking about a little bit about sort of 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter, so you know, we're talking big quantities for a chemist there, but in quantities that then allow its hardness to be determined. Okay,
and so we can test it now.
Indeed. And so what they have found is that this does appear to be harder than diamond. And how do they make this? Well, again, with the first story, we're talking about high pressures, very, very high pressures. Surprise, surprise, the same sort of thing happens here. So in order to make this hexagonal diamond, they start with very, very, very pure graphite. And graphite is the lead in your pencil, basically. That's a form of carbon. It's what we call an allotrope of carbon. It's one way of arranging the carbon atoms. So instead of three-dimensional, graphite is two-dimensional, okay? And funnily enough, it's got hexagonal rings in it. So it looks like chicken wire, basically. Oh. So graphite looks like chicken wire, and it comes in layers and layers and layers and layers of chicken wire. And they take that and they subject it to, again, 20 gigapascals, about 200,000 times the pressure of the Earth's atmosphere, and they heat it up to between 1300 and 1900 degrees Celsius. Okay. They find that if they go any hotter than that, they end up with just good old cubic diamond, but they seem to have figured out that if they maintain it between those temperatures, after having 20 gigapascals on it for 10 hours, that it seems to give this hexagonal diamond, this new form of diamond, which is kind of cool. So let's see where we go with this, because obviously, you know, diamond, is, apart from its aesthetic qualities...
Of course.
Obviously, you know, things like diamond tip saws and stuff like that. Anything where we need, you know, something very, very sharp or very, very abrasive, diamond is extremely useful in that. So if we can make an even harder form of diamond, you know, you can see obviously the advantages of that. So, yeah, as I say, let's see how this pans out and whether they can start making really bulk quantities of this and see how useful it really is. So, yeah.
Gotta love hexagons.
Absolutely.
Strong shape. And finally, we have, I mean, in celebration of a few days ago now, Pi Day.
Pi Day.
Pi. What do you got for us about Pi?
Well, Pi Day. Okay, so Saturday, in fact, was Pi Day. And the reason that they call it Pi Day is because it is the 14th day of the third month, okay? And, of course, in America, they go the other way around when they talk about dates. So they go the third month, the 14th day, 3-1-4. Okay, which are the first three digits of pi. So that's why they call it Pi Day in the States, the 14th of March. Now, obviously, if you're in New Zealand, then that would be 1-4-3. Okay, so it'd be the 14th of, the 31st of the 4th, wouldn't it? Mm. Okay, now the 31st of April doesn't exist. So Pi Day doesn't actually exist in New Zealand. But so this gives us an excuse to talk about pie. Pie is just, you know, just amazing. It's been known for literally thousands of years, and it is quite simply the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. And so its value to a few decimal places, 3.14159265536, that's what I can remember it to anyway. Most people remember it to just sort of 3.14. Now, it's got lots of special qualities. So, number one, it's in what we call an irrational number, which means it can't be written as a fraction. It can't be written of a fraction of two integers. So you'll see numbers like 22 upon 7, for example, as being approximately pi. So that comes out to 3.143. Or 355 over 113, and that comes out to 3.1416, which is, you know, getting better and better and better. But you'll still never get an exact value of pi by taking the fraction of two integers. You can't do it. We've known its value, as I say, literally for thousands of years. So Archimedes, way back in about 250 BC, okay, or BCE, should I say, is he got the lower and the upper bounds of pi as 3.1408 to 3.1429, and the actual value of pi does exist between those. And now we know it literally to trillions of digits, and that is all thanks to advances in mathematics and things called infinite series, and we're not going to get into that at all. As recently as 1949, the world record for knowing pi was 2,037 digits, and they did this on the best computer of the day in the world, and it's called the ENIAC machine, and that took 70 hours of computation to get it to 2,037 digits, okay? And we sort of think, gosh, think of the things that we can do today in, you know, milliseconds on a desktop computer, you know? Why are we interested in pi? Well, you know, pretty much everything in math depends on pi. Anything trigonometric, so sines, cosines, all of that sort of stuff, they're all going to have pi in them. Anything involving circles is going to be, you know, have some dependence on pi. And way back in 1897, the state legislature of Indiana in the USA, they nearly passed a bill that would have made pi equal to 3.2, which
feels wrong.
Which would have meant that Indiana circles would have been different from the circles in the rest of the planet. And this was all due to some pseudo-mathematician who thought that it would just make life easier if you just had pi as being a rational number and blah, blah, blah. So just sort of defying common logic. And luckily, apparently the sort of the lower house or whatever passed it. And then luckily, it came within the hearing of a mathematician who just thought, oh my God, we can't have this. And so he sort of advised. And they didn't vote against it, but it never got sort of continued on, apparently. But so here's my question. So if pi is irrational, okay, and it goes on for literally trillions and trillions and trillions of digits, it never stops, then we can't know the exact circumference of a circle.
Ooh,
because
there's
always going to be some uncertainty. We don't know the exact circumference of a circle. So my answer to that, here's my quandary here. The easy thing to do is just take your circle and cut it, and then you get a straight line. Okay? Which has got that same length as the circumference of that circle. So surely we can just measure the length of that and then we get the exact value. But we can't have the exact value in a circle. Where's my logical flaw in this? There we go. There we go, listeners.
Math.
There we go.
Math.
Have a think.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Brain bender. So good old brain bender.
That'll keep you up at night like it does me. So yeah. There we go. So that's Pi Day. The next one we're going for is Mole Day, which is 10/23, or the 23rd of October in the USA. Okay, so
awesome.
There we go.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks, Alan, for joining us. Thank you, MOTAT, and thank you, Science. STEMfear is back again at MOTAT. Enjoy hands-on activities and demonstrations next weekend,
cool.
The 28th to the 29th of March.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School. Checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
Biscuits and fresh vegetables every Tuesday from 7 p.m. Replayed 4 a.m. Wednesday and always online at 95bfm.com. Check it.
Stinky Jim. Stinky Jim.
Audio. Culture.
Tune in to 95BFM Drive every second Tuesday as they're joined by one of our friends from Audio Culture, sharing the songs, stories, and salacious scandal from which is woven the mighty tapestry of New Zealand music.
Audio Culture, more cultured than a blue cheese with a BA. Every other Tuesday on 95BFM Drive.
Thanks to Audio Culture. Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
I still
Special.
That was Cloudbusting by the wonderful Kate Bush. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, amid negotiations between the Public Service Commission and the NZEI Te Reo Roa Union over pay for primary school teachers, the government moved to offer pay rises to primary school teachers on individual agreements. The move has been criticised by the union as undermining negotiations, but the government has defended the move as simply offering those teachers what the union has already turned down. Last week also saw the release of Phase 2 of the Royal Commission inquiry into the COVID-19 response. The results were, by and large, positive towards the response, but with key points of debate still remaining. This week, I spoke to National MP Ryan Hamilton about all these topics, beginning by discussing the pay offer for primary school teachers. Last week, the government offered pay raises to non-unionised primary school teachers. What is the government's rationale behind this move?
It's quite interesting to see. The Public Service Commission obviously is enabling school boards to offer new payments to teachers who aren't union members. Obviously, those under union negotiations have been, well, those that they're working through the process and they've been ongoing for a while. But I guess it makes clear that those non-union members are also entitled to those allocations and are probably a little bit more free to accept them at a faster rate.
And how does the government defend from claims that this is undermining the collective bargaining of the unions through offering payment to non-unionised members?
Well, I mean, Sir Brian has said that he'll continue to negotiate in good faith with the unionised members, and everyone is hopeful that the bargaining process will result in a new collective agreement to be ratified by teachers who are under that primary teachers collective agreement. But I mean, non-unionised teachers also have a right to contract, and it's fair and reasonable that nearly a third of them who are not part of that union should be offered a contract so they can receive the pay increases that the government has already offered. Currently, you know, they've been limited by the ongoing negotiations or impacted by them.
Public Service Commissioner Brian Roach has even said, though, that the move is unusual. When we're looking at kind of this idea that negotiations will continue in good faith, how does unusually taking avenues to weaken the position of the union, how is that still negotiating in good faith?
It's enabling school boards to offer those agreements, and they've been accepted. And I guess they haven't got they're not heckling or negotiating or resisting or leveraging, you know, they're in a position where they thought that was a good offer and they're in a position to take it. I think it is different, but it's also, you know, why should just unions hold, you know, government departments to ransom by, you know, taking a long time to negotiate? I mean, none of the negotiation has to take ages and ages. It's about good faith. It's about making decisions and agreeing and moving on. And I guess that's the counter argument for unions.
Education has obviously been kind of a hotspot throughout the term of this government, with a lot of changes coming through towards the curriculums or the ways that we're teaching to kind of fix perceived problems. The government speaks a lot about, you know, the best interest of the education sector and teachers. How can the government claim that things are in best interest of teachers when a large proportion of teachers are in fact in this union, which they are not giving the pay rise that they are asking for?
Look, that's a negotiation between them and the commissioner. We feel that the education reforms that we've put through in a lot of ways actually support teachers, because they don't have to try and reinvent the wheel. They don't have to create curriculum and syllabus. It's all there. It's all prescribed. Not only the resource for the teachers, but the resource to support the teachers. And that's actually trying to make their life a little bit more straightforward, a bit more standardised across, you know, primary and intermediate schools. So that's also got to be of benefit to the teachers.
The union has specifically kind of pointed to these curriculum changes as a negative in their
bargaining for a pay raise. They're specifically saying that the changes brought in by the government are making their jobs harder, and so they need this pay rise. How can that then be good for the teachers if such a large proportion of teachers is saying actually no?
Well, you know, I disagree with that comment by the unions. I mean, of course the unions would say that because they're always looking to leverage and, you know, a better deal. But, you know, our government's being supportive of giving them, you know, a clear resource and the resources to do it, and supported teacher training and upgrades and actually providing clarity. So, yeah, I'd disagree with that, you know, statement or assumption.
Moving on. Last week saw the release of the second phase of the COVID-19 inquiry. This phase was commissioned by this coalition government. Can you tell us why the government believed the second phase was needed?
I think it was clear as part of the coalition agreement that there was going to be an inquiry. And I think when that first inquiry went through, there was some dissatisfaction that it was broad enough. And I think the, you know, that came through clear. So the second phase was able to, I guess, give effect to those concerns and make it broader. I mean, ideally, it would have been done in the first instance, but it wasn't. But I think that satisfies. There was a lot of concern that it wasn't broad enough and covering off some of the things like the mandates and the lockdowns of Auckland, which has come through quite clearly, obviously, in this one.
And looking to the results of this inquiry, what is the government wider, but also the National Party stance on what we are seeing coming out in these reports?
Well, I mean, the first thing is it's damning from a financial perspective. I mean, we'd already had the Treasury report come out last year about the overspend in the last sort of 6 years. But, you know, to see $60 billion but half of that not directly related to the COVID response, I think was alarming. You know, we saw all sorts of projects like Shovel Ready. The Shovel Ready projects, half of the spending wasn't actually allocated until 2 years after the announcement. So, you know, there wasn't really shovels anywhere near it. And, you know, that the Royal Commission talked about stimulatory responses should have been timely, targeted and temporary. And a lot of those things, you know, were far from that. That drove up a lot of inflation. And, you know, that's made a significant impact on Kiwis. Yeah, cost of living, which is flowing through, and then we've had to try and address that in the last 2 to 3 years. Fortunately, we've seen inflation come down, and it's meant the average mortgage has reduced by up to $10,000 a year. And prior to the Middle East conflicts, which were, you know, sort of escalated in the last few weeks, our economy was expected to grow 3% through next year and through this year and next year, and we were likely to get into surplus faster. So it's taken a lot of work, but, you know, the financial implications of that wasteful spending through COVID, you know, Kiwis are still paying for now.
On the economic side, though, the report and the inquiry showed that the Treasury believe that the government should stay the course with lockdowns in August 2021 and that they expected the economy to bounce back. The Treasury has also said in this inquiry that there were no obvious signs of high level economy indicators declining that decision makers should have been aware of. The inquiry itself has said that none of the advice that the government was given indicated any sort of severe economic fallout. What then does the National Party have to say about the fact that the Treasury, by and large, did approve of the measures and steps taken by the Labor Party, by the Labor government?
Well, you know, the report also showed that Chris Hipkins kept Auckland locked down longer than required, despite receiving advice that the restrictions could have ended sooner. Now, whether that was implicitly linked to Treasury forecasts could be argued, but he was told that the Auckland boundary was unnecessary and unpractical and could have been lifted. Despite that, he kept it in place for another 32 days after Christmas and New Year. And obviously that left businesses shut, families separated. You know, it impacted a lot of people with, you know, the ability to go to simple functions like weddings and funerals. And we think he owes an explanation to every Aucklander that went through that squeeze as to why he personally held on to those shutdowns for longer than he needed.
Looking towards the rest of the inquiry, though, a lot of the results are either positive or amiable towards the former Labor government's handling. The National Party at the time was very critical of especially the extended lockdowns, which you've talked about, but also the vaccine mandate. What is the National Party's stance on the way that vaccines were rolled out and mandated during the COVID lockdowns?
Well, the Royal Commission said that the mandates could have been released sooner. But I guess the most alarming part was the 12 to 17-year-old, you know, double shot aspect, where obviously that was a failing of both the ministry and, we'd argue, politically as well, in terms of the communication that hadn't been portrayed. But we saw that, you know, Aisha Verrill, as minister responsible at the time, had made a note in the margins expressing, you know, some concern or doubt, but there'd been no follow-up. And so, you know, arguably 12 to 17-year-olds didn't need that second shot. And that, you know, that does leave a risk and a lot of frustration for parents that trusted the process. And so that's why we've put an inquiry in to find out, or, you know, to make sure that doesn't happen again, because that's, you know, so the health minister's written to the director general on that, directing a review, because obviously vaccines are an important part of, you know, child health and protection. But when you have something like that, a breach, it can make, you know, those parents a little bit weary of entrusting government and officials, which is quite an alarming thing.
And I mean, on that, looking towards especially those concerns over the double shot, the New Zealand for us has called for a third stage of the inquiry into vaccine health impacts. What is the net? Obviously, you've just said that, you know, looking into a review around some of these, but what is the National Party's stance on a more official third inquiry into vaccine health?
I don't think we're taking a broad, I don't believe there's a broad inquiry into vaccine health. We're obviously trying to target vaccination rates, particularly in our children, and we've seen some incremental improvements in those targets. So yeah, the issue wasn't the vaccine itself, but the second dose, which raised the risk of myocarditis in an age group that had already had a very low risk. But yeah, it's just the flow-on effect from those things we've got to manage and make sure that it doesn't impact our ability to continue to keep New Zealand's healthcare and immunisations rates strong.
That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton talking about the government's pay rise for non-union primary school teachers and phase two of the Royal Commission inquiry into COVID-19.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Ooh, hang on. We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Best friend.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM.
The Wire.
Whoops. In 2023, New Zealand enacted a world-first ban on live animal exports by sea. Part of the National and ACT Coalition Agreement included plans to reverse the ban. However, last week, the government announced it would not go ahead with repealing the ban, with Associate Minister of Agriculture Andrew Hoggard saying that a consensus within Cabinet could not be achieved before this year's general election. I spoke to Deborah Ashton, Chief Executive of Safe for Animals, about the impact of the government's decision and the future for live exports and animal welfare. First off, for those who might not be aware, could you describe what live animal exports are? What is the scope of these operations and what is involved?
What is involved with live exports by sea is that animals
from New Zealand have been loaded on board ships for long journeys. More recently, these journeys were to China, and they were sending animals to China for breeding purposes so that China could basically set up their own dairy herd.
What is the global impact and the local one when New Zealand was still participating in the trade?
The purposes of this trade was to bring income into New Zealand, but our position is that animal welfare needs to be a priority, and that exposing animals to conditions on board live export ships is no way to increase our GDP.
What is the impact of these live exports on the animals involved?
Well, they're typically extremely cruel for animals. Conditions on board live export ships have failed to meet New Zealanders' expectations when it comes to standards of animal welfare. So while most of the animals will survive long journeys at sea, it's not really a true measure of animal welfare because long distance travel can be incredibly stressful for animals in an unfamiliar environment where they're exposed to unfamiliar sounds and they may have to endure rough seas. One of the worst things that we have seen is animals being completely covered in their own waste due to the fact that they are forced to live and sleep in that single environment. Also, the conditions typically lacked ventilation, which made the environment even worse for animals as the ships headed into warmer weather. And the risks associated with live export did increase due to rough weather and breakdowns at sea. We have also seen and are still seeing ships unable to reach their destination due to factors like disease outbreaks or even war. And this can leave animals stranded on board ships with little food or fresh water for days, sometimes weeks and even months at sea. So the risk is incredibly high when it comes to the welfare of the animals.
There was a petition signed by 57,000 people back in 2024 protesting the government's desire to reintroduce live animal exports. What is the power of public opinion and activists and lobby groups in changing the legal framework?
I think the public opposition to this particular trade was certainly highlighted after, in the lead up to the initial ban, and then when the members of the National Party and the ACT Party started talking about overturning the ban. So certainly I think public opposition was instrumental in ensuring that the government would not overturn the ban. And last week, you know, we heard the Minister for Trade and Agriculture, Todd McClay, say that National would no longer support the trade because it could not guarantee the animal welfare standards that New Zealanders would expect. So I think the voices of New Zealanders were heard loud and clear. The evidence of animal cruelty by veterinarians and animal welfare experts was very clear that gold standards could not be achieved on board these ships, and that the government heard those voices and, essentially the National Party heard those voices and made that decision to no longer support overturning the ban.
Could there be moves in the future to reinstate live export?
I think reinstating it is unlikely given that, you know, two major parties, Labor and National, do not support a return to the trade. The government has, you know, previously signalled its intention to revive this trade under what they called a gold standard for animal welfare. But it has been very, very clear all along that this was impossible to achieve. So conditions on board for the animals and the risks of the trade itself means that no amount of regulation can remove the suffering that animals could endure or guarantee their welfare once they arrive at the destination. I think it's pretty clear that, you know, New Zealand has led the call to ban live export, and we were heralded around the world where people look to New Zealand as leaders in this movement, and other countries are also now considering, you know, their approach to live export by sea as well.
Moving on from sort of the international aspect, Australia, which is one of the world's biggest exporters of live animals, announced their intention to ban live exports of sheep by sea by 2028. Is there a general consensus building as to the acceptability of live exports internationally?
I think it is, and we do know that there is an international movement of, you know, members of the public, animal welfare experts, veterinarians, who are all looking at the animal welfare risk. And, you know, I think there's becoming less of a social license that would support live exports. So I think there's certainly a big shift around public opinion, and I think we will start to see other countries slowly but surely move to ban live export by sea as well.
That was Deborah Ashton, Chief Executive of SAFE, speaking about the government's decision not to overturn the ban on live animal exports.
Hello, I'm John Campbell and you're listening to BFM. Amazing how I know that, eh?
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ke māua mō tēnei rā.
That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, National MP Ryan Hamilton, and Safe for Animals is Deborah Ashton. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo mā, ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got the 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.